heard earlier this morning, an attack against IS in Mosul in Iraq is looming. What of the broader context, though, behind it? Not the military one, the religious cultural backdrop. Why are these momentous shifts and conflicts erupting in so many Muslim states? And they look so intractable too, which these conflicts, which contributes to the headlines and some of the public statements, such as we've seen this week, that many of us might wish weren't made. So, naturally, questions are posed by a wide range of people, hoping for some resolution. Is the world of Islam, you hear people asking this, undergoing its own form of reformation and enlightenment turmoil, similar to Christianity's agonies 400 to 500 years ago, enduring, as it did then, this Herculean power struggle over who controlled beliefs and values, the church and the traditional establishment, or civilians and the emerging merchant class? It was a searing time, until it wasn't. Well, my first guest this hour, Shadi Hamid, says no, that Islam will probably never go through a similar transformation of separating state from religion, and that we in the West have to understand why this is the case. Shadi is an Egyptian-American Muslim. He's a senior fellow at the Project on US Relations with the Islamic World at the Brookings Institution's Center for Middle East Policy, and he's a contributing editor-writer for The Atlantic. He's also the author of Islamic Exceptionalism, How the Struggle Over Islam is Reshaping the World. And he joins me from Washington via Skype. Welcome to Saturday Extra, Shadi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Islamic Exceptionalism, that's a bold title. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so the argument that I make in my book is that Islam is fundamentally different than other major religions, and in particular how it relates to law, politics, and governance. So part of what we have to do, I think, is to be careful about imposing the model of European Christianity onto a very different religion, Islam. And we have to understand Islam on its own terms, in terms of its own history, culture, and tradition. I think too often what we do in our public debate is we want to believe that Islam will be like Christianity. It will go through Reformation, Enlightenment, then secularism, then towards the end of history of liberal democracy. And I don't think that's very helpful because it's not realistic, and I don't think it really looks at what's distinctive about Islam. And when I say Islam exceptionalism, that exceptionalism can either be good or bad depending on the context. Religion isn't always bad, and I think those of us who come from a kind of secular background in the West, whenever we hear about religion playing a role in public life, we automatically think that's a problem that has to be fought. It's more complicated than that.
Yes. I mean, in fact, you feel, if I read you correctly, that it's actually not helpful to say we're really all the same underneath it all. You know, we all eat sandwiches. You quote Ben Affleck, the actor. In fact, your 6 years living in the Middle East until recently persuaded you that we are not all the same in our cultural aspirations and that it would be better to come to terms with that. Now, what are you getting at there?
Well, so in living in the Middle East, I mean, one thing that became more and more clear to me over time is that Islam has this everyday power. And if you talk to ordinary Muslims, you get a sense of how religion is intertwined in everyday life, and that there's a kind of magic that religion offers, and that there's a sense of the supernatural. And you know, I think that I wanted to really capture that because I think the question that I get, you know, as an American from other Americans all the time is how much does Islam matter when we're trying to understand the demise of the Arab Spring or the rise of ISIS? And I think too often we don't take religion seriously as a factor. So part of what I wanted to do in my book, but also just more broadly in my work, is to bring religion back into the conversation, but hopefully in a way that is nuanced and contextual and not in the way that the right wing does, whether it's here in the US or in Europe, where if you bring religion back, it's always, oh, you know, Islam is this kind of bugaboo. So I think there's a way to have this conversation, but hopefully in a more constructive way.
Gee, you prompt so many thoughts in my mind, because after all, prior to the Reformation and the Enlightenment, just what you've described then about the power of religion was absolutely the case in Europe. It was a very public power, as it were. It was, and then it changed gradually, very gradually, actually, with a lot of death in between. And it became a more, and what it is now, much more privatized religion, whereas it is true, Islam is a very public religion. So, I mean, I'm still a little unpersuaded by your notion that this may not happen in Islam. It's terribly difficult to watch, but it might happen in Islam. It might take 200 years, but why might it not happen?
Well, first of all, you and I will be dead in 200 years. So I mean, anything is possible in the long, long run, right? I mean, I think we have to focus on the foreseeable future, the rest of our lives. And I think that this is where understanding fundamental differences between religions is important. So one example that I talk about is the founding moment. So we have to go back 14 centuries. And when we look at Prophet Muhammad, unlike Jesus, he wasn't just a prophetic figure, or in the case of Jesus, the divine figure. But Prophet Muhammad is also a politician. He's a head of state. He's a state builder.
He's a general, a very clever general.
Exactly, yes. So in that sense, the religious and political functions are intertwined in this one man. And I think that, you know, Muslims emulate the prophet. They take the prophetic model very seriously. Even if they're not the most religious people, there still is a kind of admiration there, right? So if you're a Muslim secular reformer, and there are many Muslim secular reformers who are making an argument for European-style secularism, you can make that argument, but you have to argue against the prophetic model. So you have an uphill battle.
But that's exactly what the Christians, that's people like Voltaire, had exactly that dilemma, didn't they? And they did argue it. They carried on. People were burned at the stake over it. I mean, why couldn't the prophetic model in Islam be taken on more?
Yeah, so, well, there's a couple things here. I think one is that, you know, in Christianity from the very beginning, you have this idea of coexisting with other sources of law. So in the first few centuries, you had the early Christian community accepting Roman law.
Yep.
And that there wasn't a kind of separate thing called Christian law the way we talk about Islamic law or Sharia. And Sharia is something that it's a corpus and a body of law that is, there's diverse interpretations and different philosophical approaches and schools of law. So I want to really emphasize that it isn't just one thing, but there is that basic idea that Islam does have something to say about law and governance. The closest you have in Christianity is canon law in the Catholic tradition, but even that isn't quite the same thing. That's more about the internal organization of the Catholic Church. So even if we go back 7 or 8 centuries in Christianity, there is a kind of division between civil law and ecclesial law.
Yes, definitely. Give unto Caesar that which is Caesar, and to God that which is God's. Mm.
Precisely, but you don't quite have that in the Islamic tradition. It's only really in the modern era with the advent of secularism and Western ideas are coming into the Muslim world in the Middle East, where people are like, oh, there's this thing called secularism where religion can be more privatized. But there wasn't really a discussion of that before the modern period.
So, okay, therefore, anybody who is a reformer, I take your point, has to take on an awful lot, both the prophetic tradition, the fact that there isn't an interpretive tradition in Islam, the whole business of people, the Islam, the Quran is the divine word itself, whereas, well, so was the Bible, you see. It was. And then I would argue that there became a tradition of interpretation. Do you not see that?
Well, yeah, so there is quite a bit of interpretation throughout the 14th centuries of Islamic law and tradition. But that's not the same thing as saying that people want Islam to be privatized, right? So but I think that what you pointed to right there is really important. So there is no major sector denomination Christian history that argued that the New Testament was directly from God. there was an acknowledgement of human authorship. So Paul, for example, a very important Christian figure, wrote parts of the Bible. Other disciples played a role. That is not what you have in Islam, where Muslims, to be a Muslim, really, at least if you want to be theologically Muslim and not just culturally Muslim, is to believe that the Quran is not just the word of God, but that it is God's actual speech. In other words, every letter and sentence and word comes directly from God, and there's no human role interfering or offering its own, you know. So that's why when you look at the Quran as scripture, you can't dismiss it or cast it as inapplicable or ignore it or whatever, because you're dealing with God's exact word. And that's a very, I think, important, it might sound semantic, but I think it's a very important difference between the New Testament and the Quran.
Oh no, I see what you say. And in that period, that sort of 700 years of glorious time for Islamic culture, when there was so much advance and you know disruption, to use the word of the moment, in science, in maths, for instance. So, how would you position this, what you're describing now, in that time? Did those leading thinkers, did they always stay within the prophetic tradition? I find that hard to believe, because they must have moved outside it to shift understanding, human understandings, the way they did.
Right. So, I think the starting assumption that if Islam plays a big role in public life, that would be contrary to technology, science, or philosophy. That's part of what I want to challenge as well, is that here you had Islamic philosophers and intellectuals who said, yes, the Quran is directly from God. They said, yes, Islamic law matters and is important. But they were also able, within those constraints, within that tradition, to push the boundaries, because the Quran doesn't go into minute detail on every single issue. So there has to be room for human interpretation. And obviously, too, that you take the prophetic model, but then you have to find a way to make that relevant for seven centuries later or for a different geographical context. So there's always a process of interpretation and reinterpretation. But that, so you have that, but that's not the same as secularism. That's what you have today. You have Islamic thinkers who we would call Islamists. So Islamist groups and parties that say they want Islam to play a prominent role in public life, but they are doing their own kind of interpretation. They're coming to terms with the modern nation state.
So is that the is that the? I mean, that's such a sort of challenge for Western thinking, that Islamists might be the advance guard of a form of reformation.
Yeah, so that is part of what I'm trying to argue here, is that be careful what you wish for. So we talk about, if you really want to use this analogy of reformation, and I think that's a problematic analogy, but if people really want to do that, then we can look at Islamist parties as parties that are trying to reconcile pre-modern Islamic law with the modern nation state. And in that sense, they are quite modern and modernist in their interpretation. So you have Islamist parties like the Brotherhood in Egypt or Ennahda in Tunisia or the AK Party in Turkey. These aren't people who are stuck in the 7th century, because they are talking about new concepts like democracy, elections, popular sovereignty, of how to make sense of IMF loans in the modern context. Are IMF loans religiously legitimate or not? So there is this kind of process of rethinking and reinterpreting. But what Islamists say is you still have to believe that Islam matters. They don't believe that Islam should be put in a private box off to the side.
Yes, let me just tell the listeners that Shadi Hamid is my welcome guest, a contributing writer for The Atlantic, and he works at the Brookings Institution, and we're talking about whether there are useful comparisons to be made between the sort of trajectory of change that Christianity underwent with Islam. Just because I've only got you for a couple of more minutes, you wrote a column in The Atlantic talking about the need to go back to, say, 1924, the year of the last caliphate was formally abolished, and that this is a very, very important year that is possibly overlooked. What do you mean?
Well, because really for the better part of 14 centuries, in a way until 1924, Islam was not contested as the natural order of things. Yes, maybe sometimes it played more of a role or less of a role, and there were different interpretations. But no one really questioned that this was the kind of overarching legal, moral, and religious culture. But then the Ottoman Caliphate, the last caliphate, was formally abolished, as you mentioned, in 1924. And then really ever since then, I argue, there has been a struggle to establish a legitimate political order in the Middle East. There has been this kind of religious, moral, and political vacuum. And this is the ongoing struggle which we've seen really until today, where people are trying to resolve this fundamental issue of the everyday role of religion or Islam's relationship to this state, or should the state be ideologically neutral or religiously neutral, or should it promote a particular conception
indeed,
of religion?
Indeed, but I mean, that was Turkey is the classic example, because to a lot of us, Australians are very interested in Turkey. Turkey looked pretty good. You know, that was Kemal Atatürk doing all of that, abolishing the caliphate and changing so dramatically the internal sort of workings of Turkey. And it's, despite coups and so on, you know, Turkey was really advancing. It was a fabulous place to go to. And then President Erdogan clearly did not like the Turkey that was underway. And here we are in this sort of, I don't know what we're in at the moment with Turkey. Not a happy place. So, I mean, is that an advance or a regression?
Well, I think Turkey supports the point quite well, is that here you have Atatürk coming in and imposing this very aggressively secular vision on what was until then a quite pious and religious culture. And it worked to an extent for a certain period of time, but there were still millions of Turks who said, hey, we're okay with some parts of this secular project, but we still want to be able to express our religion publicly and without fear of persecution. So over time, Turks started to vote for Islamically oriented or Islamist parties more and more in the 90s and more recently in the 2000s with the AK Party of President Erdogan. And that shows that you can't force people to be liberal or secular if they don't want to be liberal or secular. So what Turks were saying is we don't want to erase religion from the public sphere. So even in a case where you have decades of forced secularization, the script of the language was changed.
And he changed the weekend. I mean, it was extraordinary when you look at what he did.
Exactly. So you have these radical changes, but that shows that it's not sustainable to force that, and that there has to be a willingness to come to terms with Islam's role in public life, whether we as Westerners like it or not. And we are seeing how religion is becoming more part of the public sphere under Erdogan. And Erdogan does seem to have a vision of kind of this soft Islamization. He's not going around implementing Islamic law or cutting people's hands off.
We'll see. It's a work in progress, I think.
Yes. And I think what we have to accept is that that's going to have to play itself out over time. And we'll have to wait and see, really, in the case of Turkey.
Shadi, I'm sorry we could talk for a while. We will have you back, I promise you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me. My pleasure.
Shadi Hamid, whose book is Islamic Exceptionalism, How the Struggle Over Islam is Reshaping the World. And you can hear there's lots of ideas, and we just didn't have time to go further.